Race and Religion, next on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me now for part three in a series of programs for Black History Month. You'll hear from Lori Maffley Kipp of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and from Peter Gomes of Harvard University. Lori Maffley Kipp is here to talk about race and religion in 19th century America. Before that, Peter Gomes discusses early American religion, ethnicity, and cultural pluralism.
I don't want to be limited to the lineaments of my own experience. I want to be able, in any and every way, to transcend my experience. I want the variety available to me. Uh-huh. And I also want that for young people. So I don't, one of the things that troubles me very much is that people think they can only learn from people who look like them or who share their immediate cultural experience. I think that that is a very depriving and limiting experience.
Peter Gomes of Harvard University. He'll be back in just a moment to talk about religion and race in American culture. Partial funding for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center. As a starting point for a discussion during Black History Month, early American religion may at first sound odd or inappropriate. Yet the links between ethnicity and the practice of religion in early America are stronger than apparent. So says Peter Gomes, who serves as the Dean of Harvard Chapel in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He notes that the Puritans have become icons of early American culture, noteworthy as both colonizers and investors in the commercial aspects of the New World. Yet they were driven by a sense of religious fervor, by a vision of the presence of God in everyday life. Good intentions notwithstanding, they also helped indirectly to establish a moral atmosphere that some of their inheritors used to justify the practice of slavery, a social enormity whose ill effects we're still living with. As a result, the Puritans' long shadow has an important bearing on our modern notions of race and ethnicity. In addition to his work as Dean of Harvard Chapel, Peter Gomes is also president of the Pilgrim Society in Plymouth, Massachusetts, and a professor at Harvard University. Before coming to questions of race and ethnicity, I asked Peter Gomes to describe the Puritan world on its own terms, a world that seems altogether different from our modern multicultural society.
Well, in one respect they are, but they bring two competing values which I think compete continually for the attention of the Republic. On the one hand, they are very individualistic, personal piety, personal salvation, personal honor and integrity, the rigorous captain of their own soul, that sort of thing. And that individualistic strand is an American blessing and a curse, and we owe it much to them. But the other side is equally important. They are incredibly civic-minded. They believe in the city of God. They believe in an ordered and rational society and trying to perfect life on earth insofar as that is possible. So they are into institutions and communities and networks, and that is also part of the American genius.
Well, now the Puritans are known, as you say, for many characteristics, these two that you have just paused on, Peter Gomes. They're also known for a great strong belief in human depravity.
Yes.
Now, how is it that we connect them with this great American republic that believes so strongly in the perfectibility of humankind, and yet we have this direct linkage back to these people who said, we live in a fallen world?
Well, they're wonderfully ambiguous, and they could hold not only two thoughts at the same time, but two contradictory thoughts.
Now, they sound like politicians all of a sudden.
They do indeed. They certainly did understand they lived in a fallen world, and evidences of it were all around them, and because of the fallen nature of the old world, at least, they fled to this one. And pretty quickly discovered that you don't flee from your fallen nature. You just sort of reorganize it.
You relocate.
Relocate it, which is exactly what they did.
Right.
And yet, given the nature of their fallen nature, their enterprise was to make the best of it that they could. And so they did try to build idealized society, and by the time the Republic comes along, much of their zeal for society building has been secularized. But I think that in America, at least, politics has always been a construct of religion, and religion has always, in some sense, been a pious expression of worldly political ambition. So that the notion of the separation of church and state, as we now understand it in this country, I think, is, to all intents and purposes, a useful fiction, a kind of fig leaf. And every once in a while, we see just how intertwined these institutions and ideologies really are.
Well, as we are recording this conversation, Peter Gomes, the Supreme Court is considering the possibility of, what should we call it, realigning our sense of this relationship between the church and the state. How would you say the Puritan ethos or legacy, how does it come to us in the 1990s? You see this from the standpoint of a scholar of history. You are an ordained minister, the dean of Harvard Chapel. You talk to students, you talk to older people, and you look way back in our history at the same time. How about it?
Well, one of the most consistent legacies, I think, from the 17th century is the desire to be able to reconcile head and heart in this enterprise. How does one reconcile the rational, calculating, small scientific enterprise that we have, our gifts of mind, with a vital and sincere piety that allows us to believe in things that we can't see and impels us to try to do the good even when it's inconvenient or difficult. And the Puritans wrestled with that. They didn't come to an absolute resolution or conclusion, but that was their constant agenda. Their moral agenda was that reconciliation. And I think that still is, by and large. Some people come to an answer of that question on the ground that integrity says that they have to yield to the head in these matters, and so they become the secular humanists of the age. They become the scientists, the scientific types, the rationalists. And others say, no, you have to yield to the heart, and they become, in their most extreme form, anti-intellectual or suspicious of ideas and live in a separate realm. And it's the somewhere between those two extremes and addressing those tensions that I think is the continuing inheritance of the Pilgrims.
You make me think of that wonderful line in, is it Huckleberry Finn? Mark Twain puts these words into the narrator's mouth. He's talking about this little 14-year-old boy who's struggling with the moral dilemma of slavery. And he says he has a sound heart and a deformed conscience. We have this interplay between what's, as you just said, what is in your heart and what is in your mind. That too much of a stretch?
No. And I think we see terribly vivid expressions of the warm heart and the deformed conscience, which sometimes leads to extremely outrageous behavior. I mean, the best example of you know, acting on one's the strength of one's heart and trying to transform one's conscience, in my opinion, is something like the Civil Rights Movement and Martin Luther King and all that preceded and has descended from that. The example of the warm heart and the deformed conscience, for example, would be the sort of violence that attends those people who are anti-abortion and where people like that doctor in Florida get murdered out of the extreme direction of the warm heart and the deformed conscience.
Well, apropos of these references that you have just made, Peter Gomes, I mentioned Mark Twain, you mentioned Martin Luther King Jr. Let me present you with, respectfully present you with something of an oddity or a contradiction. Here you are, an African-American citizen of the United States, a preacher, and yet you are a devotee of the Puritans, who are the, as you said early in our conversation, the icons of white authority in this society. Is that a contradiction?
No, I don't think it's a contradiction at all.
Tell me about it.
Why should I be not permitted, or why should I be prevented from choosing anybody in the pantheon of creation with whom I can identify or whose values are interesting to me?
Not to mention the fact that you were born in Plymouth,
well,
Massachusetts.
Exactly. I think that I don't want to be limited to the lineaments of my own experience. I want to be able, in any and every way, to transcend my experience. I want the variety available to me, and I also want that for young people. So I don't. One of the things that troubles me very much is that people think they can only learn from people who look like them or who share their immediate cultural experience. I think that is a very depriving and limiting experience.
Let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation, Peter Gomes. What would you do in your position as the president of the Pilgrim Society from the vantage point of your duties as the dean of Harvard Chapel? What do you do to make the Puritans and that part of our heritage available to this country as something other than just like a tourist trap?
Yes.
The curio shop mentality. What about this?
Well, it takes a lot of work, and I've spent all my life trying to do that. But they represent tremendous metaphors in which all of us have engaged. All of us have left an old world of some kind or another and embarked upon a new and dangerous and unknown adventure. All of us have tried to reconcile the passionate and the rational within us. All of us have tried to live with ideals in the face of realities that sometimes won't let us do this. All of us have had a fascination and a desire to leave an imprint upon posterity. These are not racially restrictive characteristics, and these are not simply antiquarian ideals. I mean, these are the very things that make societies work and go, and these people happen to be able to have done this for us, for all of us, and to sort of awaken that in their disparate successes of all ages and races and classes is my ambition.
Peter Gomes, I appreciate very much your contribution to Soundings and your visit here at the National Humanities Center. I cannot let you get away without reminding you of that wonderful line from H.L. Mencken, that it was the Puritans, what was it?
Who landed at Plymouth Rock. The Pilgrims landed worthy men, and they fell first upon their knees and then upon the Aborigines. One would expect that from somebody from Baltimore who didn't really know much about New England.
Well, that's a wonderful line, but what I was thinking of is that accusation that the Puritans are the people who are worried that somewhere, someplace, somebody is having fun.
There's a fair amount of that, and I think their successes are legion, and they occupy some of the largest denominations in this country, alas.
Well, Peter, I really appreciate your willingness to stop by the National Humanities Center and participate on Soundings. I wish you well in your work at Harvard University. Peter Gomes, the Dean of Harvard Chapel and the President of the Pilgrim Society, thank you so much for coming by. Good luck in your work.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond with part three in a series of programs for Black History Month, Race and Religion. Join me now for a conversation with Laurie Maffley Kipp, a professor of religious studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
Well, one of the consequences was that these denominations, the primarily black denominations, the AME Church, the AMEZ Church, which stands for African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church, were suddenly forced to cope with this influx of thousands and thousands of Southern blacks who had understood religious experience in very different ways from their Northern counterparts, those blacks who had been free most of their, if not all of their lives.
Historian Laurie Maffley Kipp, she's at work on a book about race and religion in 19th century America. The title of her project is African American Communal Narratives. Laurie Maffley Kipp's starting point is an exploration of denominationalism. She says that during the 19th century, that term meant something altogether different compared to what it means to us today. In 1994, we recognize the long history underscoring the separation of various Protestant churches in this country. But even though there were doctrinal differences among the churches 100 years ago, the general notion was that all religious belief was equally valid. More important, a factor such as ethnicity did not necessarily shape the expression of one's religious practice. There was, strictly speaking, no such thing as a black church. I asked Lori Maffley Kipp to explain how ethnicity came to affect the practice of religion in 19th century American culture.
Well, the way that I try to bring it in is by recognizing that for blacks as well as for whites, denominationalism was not a stable category. It was something very much still in formation. And so that it provided blacks a way of defining their own religious and institutional life, because it was an open category.
Do we talk about, shall we call it the black church? I mean, that's a sort of convenient label that we have today, but I take it doesn't transfer backward in time very well.
No, there were many black churches. That's part of the problem, is there is no one monolithic black church. And that term comes to be used by the end of the 19th century really as a theological category for the idea that all of these black churches are part of something, some racial entity that's larger than themselves. But in the early 19th century, there were blacks joining separate black churches. There were blacks who stayed within primarily white churches. There were, you know, blacks who formed separate churches but remained affiliated with white denominations.
Tell me briefly, Lori, about a couple of men that you were writing about during the 19th century when we speak of denominationalism, race, and American society. One man's name is Payne, the other man's name is Tanner. This is a big order, but give me a brief summary of their careers.
Daniel Alexander Payne was a bishop in the African Methodist Episcopal Church, which was the first black, separate black denomination to form in 1816 in Philadelphia. And he became one of the most important bishops in the church in the 19th century, and became also its leading historian, so that he is most kind of widely known for his writings about the church and what I see as his constructing of a community for the church.
He not only lived in it, he wrote about it and helped, in effect, to define it
as he
lived in it.
By writing a history of it. He was helping to define it at the same time.
What about Mr. Tanner?
Benjamin Tucker Tanner is probably best known. He was also in the AME church and is best known for his journalism. He was a journalist, an editor for the AME Church Review in the 1870s, starting in the 1880s. Prior to that time, he had been an editor at the AME Christian Recorder. And so both of those were quite widely read religious periodicals.
Now, these are not names that are household names by any means,
no.
Lori.
No.
How is it that Payne and Tanner leave an imprint on our sense today of what it means to practice religion and to be black or to be white? We're treating some very large questions.
Right. Well, they aren't widely known names. Most of the names that you will find associated with the black church in the 19th century aren't widely known names. That's part of the problem, is that people don't read about these figures and don't know very much about them generally. I think they're important because it demonstrates, again, the way that African Americans were trying to come to terms religiously with the separation of the races in the United States.
Now, we could talk about biology. We could talk about racial identity. We could talk about blood. I mean, at a level that basic, when we try to figure out what was denominationalism and what was the black church, do you use biological constructs as you come to this discussion?
I talk about biological constructs because one of the interesting things for me is that just as a notion of what a denomination was coming into formation in the early 19th century, at the same time, the notion of what race meant was changing very dramatically. It was moving from kind of the Enlightenment-based concept of a culture who differs, the race was a culture that differed from other races by virtue of cultural differences, primarily social and environmental differences.
Rather than biological
differences. But in the early 19th century, that starts to shift, and race becomes a biological category by the mid-19th century.
And that happens, to make an enormous generalization. One of the reasons that happens is political. That is to say, one group of people appropriating power in order to run the lives of another group of people.
That's right. And in fact, ironically, one of the things that causes that shift is the anti-slavery movement. people who were advocating the freedom of all slaves in the United States were met on the other side by the slavery advocates, the pro-slavery advocates in the South, who constructed this idea of a biological definition of race in order to justify the continued enslavement of blacks as a permanently inferior people.
Now, one of the terms that we could put on the table, Laurie Maffley Kipp, is it's a wonderful scholarly term here, essentialism. That is to say, because that person is of a different color and a different cultural stripe compared to you or me, that person is not only, we will never be able to get into that person's mind. We will never really understand motivations, human psychology. Is that the kind of formula or paradigm, I suppose, that you apply to trying to understand black racial and religious identity?
Well, again, it's a paradigm that I think came along with the notion of a biological differences among races, that there is some essential biological difference between races, so that whites will never fully understand blacks, for example. I don't happen personally to ascribe to that, but I'm trying to describe a historical context in which that understanding of race was predominant, both for whites and for blacks.
Is your job as a scholar, Laurie Maffley Kipp, to reject that kind of ideology, however subtly or however overtly, in addition to sort of telling the story, the historical tale itself?
Well, I suppose I do reject it. I mean, it's sometimes you struggle to, I think, to hide your own assumptions and assertions about what you're doing. But certainly, I don't believe that race is a biological category. And I think most scholars today would agree with that.
Uh-huh.
So one of the purposes by historicizing that understanding of race is a way of, as Anthony Appiah has put it, to disrupt that discourse.
Fair enough. You write in your project, Laurie Maffley Kipp, about what it means to have religious experience, to be religious. You also talk about a sort of religious crisis that occurred among black people in their striving for belief and racial and religious identity. Again, a big order, but unpack that one for me.
Well, it's to call emancipation for Southern blacks a crisis is kind of an ironic way of putting it, because in fact, this is something that blacks had been striving for years and years, as well as many whites.
It was a consequence of emancipation.
Right. One of the consequences was that these denominations, the primarily black denominations, the AME Church, the AMEZ Church, which stands for African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church, were suddenly forced to cope with this influx of thousands and thousands of Southern blacks who had understood religious experience in very different ways from their Northern counterparts, those blacks who had been free most of their, if not all of their lives, so that it creates a crisis in the churches over what religious experience is all about and what are the appropriate ways of expressing religious belief.
Well, now, one of the ways, I look at you completely straight-faced, Laurie, one of the ways that you deny, again, this notion of essentialism and that you approach this idea of religious identity and religious crisis is the fact that you're a white person writing about black cultural and religious questions. Am I to assume that eventually the study, the kind of investigation that you're engaged on, will lead us to some sort of mutual racial harmony? Is that what we're headed?
That's a tall order for one book, but certainly part of my goal is, yes, to try to bring together different historical traditions. One, I think, is the white tradition of talking about white Protestantism as something completely separate from black Protestantism.
Uh-huh. In other words, we're capable of understanding one another.
I hope so. Uh-huh. I hope so. I like to think so, because I don't think, I mean, when we say one another, you're automatically presuming that these are two different
categories.
Types of people.
Uh-huh. What does the kind of work that you're engaged in, Laurie Maffley Kipp, have to do with our current debate and understanding? Some people would, I think it's fair to use the word obsession or preoccupation, with this marvelous term multiculturalism, understanding our own diversity and our own unity. Let's conclude again on a big order.
Okay. Multiculturalism itself, I think part of the problem with it is that it puts people into categories that are in and of themselves not monolithic categories. By talking about black people or talking about white people, you're assuming that all black people share certain kinds of characteristics, or all whites do. I don't think that's true. I think there are other kinds of identities that cut across racial or cultural identities. There are religious identities, regional identities, I mean, all sorts of ways we have of constructing ourselves. And I guess if you want to use the the latest academic parlance for that, I think there are other ways of, I mean, just defining oneself. Mm-hmm. We all have our various ways. I had a very interesting experience in a class a few years back where I always have my undergraduates go around the first day of the class and give me one word that defines themselves. Right, so each of them gets to choose that one word, and there were a variety of words that came up. There was one African-American student in the class, and he was the last person to give the word that defined himself. And the word he gave was male, not black, not African-American. And all of the other students in the class did this double take, like, well, don't, I mean, of course they assumed that he would think of himself first as African-American, so that it gives you some sense of the complexity of talking about people's identities. That in various contexts, at various times, we see ourselves in different ways.
Laurie Maffley Kipp is a professor of religious studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. She's writing a book about African-American communal narratives. The program is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. In just a moment, I'll tell you where to write if you'd like to have an audio cassette of this week's show. You've been listening to the third segment in a series of programs for Black History Month 1994. This week, my guests were Peter Gomes of Harvard University and Laurie Maffley Kipp of UNC Chapel Hill. For a cassette tape of this program, send $10 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 699. That's program number 699, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code again, 27709. Next week, Soundings for Black History Month will continue. Julius Chambers, Chancellor of North Carolina Central University, will be here to talk about education and the role of America's historically black colleges and universities. You'll also hear a discussion about the origins of African-American literature. My guest on that portion of the program will be Philip Richards of Colgate University. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Partial support for this program came from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.